nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
I hope you feel as I do that we're doing something very important, and I think we'll all look back in 20 years. I'll be retired, you students won't be, but we'll look back on this period and we'll be able to say we helped create the NanoHub. This evening is not to do any work, it's just to relax. But we have an after-dinner speaker that I think you'll enjoy. Dr. Bo Lojek is a principal scientist at Atno Corporation in Colorado Springs. He's also an adjunct professor of electrical engineering at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs. And for those of you that don't know, Atno is an industry leader in ASEC, non-volatile memories. Dr. Lojek has worked in the semiconductor field for about 40 years, I believe. A few months ago, I became introduced to him when he sent me a copy, a pre-publication copy of a new book that is going to appear, I think it's going to be published by Springer next month, called History of Semiconductor Engineering. I thought I was pretty familiar with the history of semiconductor technology. I know about Kilby, and I know about Moore, and I know about everybody. But as I read the book, I realized that I only knew the official history of semiconductor engineering. Now, it also turns out that Dr. Lojek is a NanoHub user. And when I found that out, I invited him to come and be on our users panel. So he'll be here on Wednesday talking about his experiences in using the NanoHub. But he kindly agreed to come a little bit early and to tell us about the real history of semiconductor engineering. So would you please welcome Dr. Lojek.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I need to thank you to Professor Lundstrom to giving me opportunity to talk about my last baby. I spent almost 3 years to working and researching my basement. And it took me another 8 months to find another publisher, because the original publisher, World Scientific, refused to publish a chapter about William Shockley. And I refused to remove it from book because I met Bill Shockley when I was a young boy in 1960. And at that time, I was planning that I will be a movie director because I want to be there where the beautiful girls are. And he told me that you will just waste time and there is new field coming and you should go into solid state physics. And I follow his advice, and now I am telling to my sons and my friends that this was only wise decision I did in my life. So I will have no time to go through all what is in chapter, but what is in the book, but I have here some flyers, so you can keep this flyer, and the book should be out in 2 months. What I want to show you today is the technology which was used for first planar integrated circuits. This is not well known, and there are actually very little photographs, no sample is, Jay Last, who was managing this group at Fairchild, he keep a lot of materials, but there is no sample of this first integrated circuits. So I will go through this in more details, but before, I need to give you some essence why my book was refused by one publisher and fortunately was accepted by another publisher. So this is how the cover will look like, and you have here on right side the chapter which are in the book. I was writing only what I am familiar or what I was involved with. There is nothing about lasers and about optoelectronics and about some other field. I did nothing else in my life than silicon. I started work on bipolar transistor. Actually, my first job was to cut a rubellite mask for 2N696, and I still keep this rubellite in my basement. But because of Shockley, I was... you probably heard the name of Shockley, but that's really, you know that he was somehow associated with Bell Labs, and he was crucial to developing a bipolar transistor. But that's only part of the story about William Shockley. So I will tell you later some story about him. Now, I want to answer a couple questions. You know that, is there somebody who regularly read books? How many books per year you read? Well, you see, that is the first problem. People are not reading. People are watching a movie and TV and what is the difference between book and TV? When you read a book, you create your own picture. You need to think. If you watch a movie or TV, you are following somebody else's thought or ideas. In our field, in every textbook, or if I talk to people, all they told me, oh, Kilby and Bob Noyce did it. I worked for Bob Noyce 3 years. I was his member of his technical advisory board, and I know him, I can say, reasonably well. The problem was that I met him in his second part of his life, and every discussion with Bob Noyce end up with discussion about flying. He doesn't want to talk about transistor or technical stuff anymore, okay? But you will see from the documents which are in a book that the Kilby and Noyce, they were employed by a big company, and they were really not the people who did the real work in fab and experiments and with silicon. So next question is, why we have not been told the truth? Why? If you open any magazine, any channel, and you think about this, you see that everything what is on in what we call media is designed to prevent you from thinking. They don't want that you think, because if you think, you may ask question, and you can see the things in different way. If you are thinking, it's difficult to manipulate you, right? And there is one person who understands this really well. It was George Orwell. Who read some of the George Orwell books? Now, if I am running this country, I would not issue the driver license to anybody unless he passed a test from 1968. That's the book by George Orwell. Why is that? Because when I was, as you see, when I keep my mouth shut, nobody recognizes that I am not American. But when I open my mouth, the people, the first question which they asked me, where did you come from? And I was born in a very difficult time. I grew up after war, and I grew up in Prague in Czechoslovakia. And we cannot read this book. This was the George Orwell books. They were distributed in handwritten copies or typewriter copies. And when I read this book, and I was pretty young, I was wondering how this man who never lived in communist country, who never visited a communist country, how come that he understands so well what's going on? Well, situation changed in 1968 when Red Army rolled over my country and I was stripped of my citizenship and I end up here. But when I end up here, I said, well, I should read George Orwell in English. Maybe that is something that they missed something. And I read it again and I think about this and I said, well, maybe the George Orwell was not exactly writing about communist country. But that's what I leave on you. You need to make some, once you become older, you will see that the technical part is only one side of life. When I was young, I worked for Toshiba, and there was something what was aluminum gate in 4004 CMOS series. And we started to convert it to polysilicon, and I was in charge of polysilicon deposition. And I remember I was sleeping next to tube in clean room because I was thinking if we don't have a polysilicon, something bad happened, or end of the world or something. But nothing's happened, and today the college kids will come to FAP and they just tear knobs and running polysilicon, and it's not a big deal. And once you are older, you will recognize that there is something more than technical work. You sometimes need to think what you are doing. My father came here and he, you know, Atmel, it's big player in non-volatile ASIC, but we also do a lot of non-volatile stuff for Sony PlayStation and Nintendo and all this game console. And my father told me, son, you are doing wrong work. You should not do it. And well, I said, that's easy to say. You should not, that's my work is only what I have, and I really enjoy what I'm doing, and I just cannot stop. But when you think about this, you will realize that you, even if you are a technical person, you should be concerned what is going around us and what is going on in society. Next question is that if I said that Kilby and Noyce was only partially involved in it, why the people who did it, why they don't shout, I did it and I want a Nobel Prize and I want the credit? The problem is that the people who are real engineers, they don't care too much about recognition. They enjoy what they are doing. They enjoy this technical process of discovery and realization of their ideas and putting this into production. The typical example is Jean Hernet. Who knows who is Jean Hernet? You see, that's what is really painful for me, because Jean Hernet was friend of mine, and he is the guy who developed a planar process. There will be no integrated circuits without his idea. The problem with Jean Hernet was that he really don't care about anything what people think. He just cared about his experiment, and he was living in his world, and he don't care about money or about recognition. And he... Okay. Jean Hernet was one of the eight engineers who defected from Shockley Labs and they established Fairchild Semiconductor. And I will show you in minutes that one foil, which is from his notebook, that he actually conceived this idea of planar circuit in 1958. It was almost 3 years before the integrated circuits, the first integrated circuit was built. But at that time, he was preoccupied with building of Fairchild and developing a new the transistor and he returned to this idea later. But if there is a person who should get a Nobel Prize, that's Jean Herner, because he was remarkable engineer. He was physicist with 2 PhD degrees from Geneva University. He was born in Switzerland, and he has another PhD from Cambridge University. And he came to United States like postdoc, and he worked with Linus Pauling. And he was accomplished scientist when Bill Shockley find him and ask him to join his group. What I listed here, that this could be also used like warning for you, because if you want to build a career and if you want to achieve something what is financial reward or what is some recognition, you should avoid all of these items. If you are now in a semiconductor manufacturing environment, and if you have a strong will, and if you are willing to oppose some idea with your boss, that's when you start to digging your work, your grave. There is a so big surplus of labor force for semiconductor industry that nobody will have any difficulties to fire at you and hire at people who are waiting in HR. So that could be a practical lesson which you can learn from this evening. But I go now back to more serious stuff. This is Jay Last, is one of the 8 people who established a Fairchild, and he was manager of the group who developed integrated circuits. The story of integrated circuits started in 1959. The TI was doing extremely large publicity about what they call molecular electronics. And in 1959, they introduced the first idea about circuits on convention in electronic. At that time, there was no IEEE, this was IRE. At the IRE convention, they introduced this concept of molecular electronics. And suddenly, even these magazines for women, they were describing how electronic works and everything was. And there was another convention, what was called WESCON in Los Angeles the same year. And Bob Noyes asked Jay Last, look, this TI is doing so much publicity about this molecular electronics. You should look on it if there is something what we can do. And that's how this process triggered. And Last, what he summarized in this paragraph is that we basically celebrate only these people who bring a torch to the finish line. And we completely forgot about this, the monumental work of many people who start or participate in the process. So to be at the Purdue University, I need to start with semiconductor research at Purdue. Right, and this is also what is not really well known. The point contact transistor would not work without Purdue work. And how this happened, I will explain you on. In 1942, Vannevar Bush established Office of Research, and they started to work on really scientific methods which can be used during the war. William Shockley was transferred to Pentagon, and he developed what is called operational research, which was used when a submarine heading on some mission, how they can avoid mines, and he was crucial in developing of sonobuoy, which was basically the monitor which traced the Nazi submarine. And what is interesting that at that time, that when Shockley was working on it, he was working on this with Bob Weidler's father, which I didn't know until I was going through Shockley paper, and I realized that he was actually giving some award to Walter Weidler, who was the father of famous designer who established linear integrated circuits field. But here at the Purdue, there was a group of people, and they did absolutely marvelous work. If you go through this report, they publish every 6 months report, and it's stuck about 4 inches thick report. And if you want to understand this characterization of semiconductor and it's remarkable reading. You can, once you start, you cannot drop it. But the Purdue group did something what they call a high back voltage rectifier. And I was puzzled with this high back voltage rectifier. What is high back voltage rectifier? It's basically high resistivity germanium. And Bell Labs transistor didn't work until the John Bardeen attend a physics conference that where the Karl Lark Horowitz group presented these papers. And he had a lunch with Walter Brettine, and he said, well, we should try to use this high back voltage rectifier like at Purdue. What this high back voltage is, that this is high resistivity germanium, and you can assume right away that this resistivity has something to do with width of depletion layer. The Bell Labs, until this moment, they were using a low resistivity germanium, and the depletion layer spread much farther than in this high resistivity germanium. And once the Brettine tried this high resistivity germanium, it took 6 weeks and transistor was working. Okay. They never acknowledged this, and you know, there is actually one speech which Brettine gave in 1960. There was physics symposium in Prague, and they first time met with Russian physicist Abram Yoffe. And there was somebody asked a question, why you didn't recognize this importance of minority carriers? Because all these Russian papers, there was another guy was named Davidov, Boris Davidov, and he in 1932 described basically depletion approximation in terms which we are using now. And Bardeen was familiar with these papers because if you look into Physical Review and you go through references, they were using this. But the Brettine says, well, we cannot imagine that the minority carriers will play dominant role in this. So they were actually assuming that they are in much lower concentration, and it took another 6 months after discovery of point contact transistor when Shockley created a theory of junction transistor, and we got a better understanding of transistor behavior. But you should be proud that this group at Purdue did remarkable work, and I just wish it's better recognized. Now I want to go on a couple of foils and go through this Kilby and Bob Noyce patterns. You know, Texas Instrument claimed that what you see on the right side, there is patent 3138743, and this is basically what TI was using to scalp everybody, and all manufacturers need to pay money because they say, no, there's integrated circuits, that's this idea, and you need to pay. And I found that there was very similar patent which was issued. The Jack Kilby patent was filed on February 6, 1959. But there was another guy who was working in RCA, and he filed patent on May 21st, 1953. 6 years before, the Kilby, this release his discovery. And I would encourage you to go and read both these patterns, because some of the paragraphs are identical. Actually, the Howard, the idea was more planar than Kilby. The Kilby was still using a loose wire to connect a transistor to pads. This was, you know, it looked more monolithic than in Kilby. The sad story is that RCA is not in business anymore. Howard Johnson is dead, and there is no public relationship who can push for this and say no, that this Kilby patent should be never issued, because there was prior art before this patent. Right? Well, let's look now on Noyce and Herner. This page on left side is copy of notebook of Jean Herner. He told me that he was taking a shower and he stopped and ran into work because he got this idea. How he got this idea is that the Shockley maintained a very good relationship with Bell Labs when he established his operation in Mountain View. And the Bell Labs provided him with all memos and all paperwork about research. And one report, which was authored by a person was named Frosch, they developed this oxidation to protect a p-n junction. So the problem with Mesa transistor was that this Mesa transistor has exposed a collector base junction. Right? So when Fairchild built a first Mesa transistor and they put them into Minuteman and they put them on vibration test, some particle drop from can and transistor start leaking. And that was big issue with the Mesa transistor. And Bell Labs, they were aware of it. And what this chemist Frosch did, he was in charge of oxidation, and one time he forgot to close the hydrogen valve. And he suddenly realized that the samples came out nicely blue. And if I say nicely blue, they were covered with oxide. If it's blue, what thickness was it? When I was young, we measure the oxide by color, right? Every thickness has a different color, so that's how you recognize what thickness. So this mistake actually resulted that they have a p-n junction, and because he forgot close the hydrogen, oxygen was running, he was basically growing a wet oxide. And this wet oxide covered a junction, and device behave very nicely. And this memo was sent to Shockley, and Shockley right away copied this, and I have a copy of routing list where is Noyce, Gordon Moore, Jay Last, and Jean Herner. And Jean Herner was thinking about this, and there was more group, like this RCA group was also working, but they apply this to germanium, and to grow this oxide on germanium is much more difficult than oxide on silicon. But you need to notice this date on this bottom line with this red arrow says read and understood December 1st, 1957, R and Noyce. Okay, 1957. And this is, on the right side, this is copy from Herner application, which was filed in 1959, 2 years later. So let's go now to this description, how the first integrated circuits at the Fairchild was built. I told you that Bob Noyce asked Jay Last to look what the TI is doing and come up with some idea what we can do. So Jay is he graduated from MIT, and his background is optics. So he was actually doing most of the part on mask and mask alignment. But He worked with Robert Norman from Fairchild Application Department, and Bob Norman said, well, first things what we should do, we should try a simple RS flip-flop. Okay, so he drew a schematic with four transistor RS flip-flop, and that's what the group start to build. And they start with this process what they know, what was developed by Jar Herner for a planar transistor. So they start with N-type substrate, which was about 80 angstrom thick. Now, how thick is 8-inch or 300 millimeter wafer? Well, it's about 800 micron, so about 10 times thinner wafer. You know, but at that time they can do it because the wafer diameter was about, in best case, 6 millimeters, 8 millimeters. Okay? And they put these small pieces of silicon into boat and they oxidize them. They grow about 8K oxide and they put a first mask on it. And they open these opening for base and P resistors region. Okay? And at that time there was no ion implantation. It was all doping was done by process which was called predeposition and dry fin. So you basically grow oxide which was highly doped, and after that you dry fin that you move the dopants from the oxide into silicon. And so these pink areas are basically base area or P resistors. After that, with next mask, so when you finish this doping, you still have oxide on top of this base region. And so you can apply the next mask, and the next mask is opening for emitter. And you repeat this process that you grow oxide, this time it's N-type dope oxide, and you create a N-plus region. And now, once you have a base and emitter, backside of the wafer will serve like collector, and you have a working transistor. And so on this last picture on the bottom, you see that by grinding, you remove the oxide from backside, you evaporate some contact on backside, and you have a planar transistor working. The world first planar transistor was 2N696, and this was this 696 exists in two versions. They were built like Mesa transistor, and after that the Fairchild keep a same type number. They just change a spec sheet and they built a Mesa transistor. And you see this on this chart, the major difference between Mesa and planar transistor, this leakage is significantly lower and flat. Okay, that this was the major improvement what Fairchild did. And at that time, there was no competitor who can come even close to Fairchild and do something like that. So they sell a first transistors to IBM, and they can charge the $150 a piece. It was heyday. What else is on this picture? That's the Jean Herner. And the sad story also is that if you are reading some story what Gordon Moore published on the internet or in some magazine, he said Jean Herner set up a desk and was teaching physics. That's grossly unfair, because Jean Herner actually didn't plan to leave Shockley lab. Shockley was hiring him that when he was working in Bell Labs, they have a mathematician in the department, and he wanted the Herner will be his theoretician. So he actually, for several months, Jean Herner was not working in this lab in San Antonio Road. The Shockley rent apartment for him because he wanted, he has a quiet environment and he can calculate basically Fick law. He was the Herner prepare a this error function and Gaussian function diffusion profile, and he calculated basically by hand in this apartment. But he was very unhappy because he wanted to do experimental work. And he was literally begging Ashok leader, he wanted to do some work. And once he left, the HERNE was crucial to develop a boron diffusion, which was at that time especially difficult. Some funny story, because he enjoyed to work overnight. It was impossible to get him into work at 9 or 10 o'clock. He was still sleeping. He come to work late afternoon, and he liked to work overnight. And he blew up a hole into wall because the tube explode The things like this happen, but we need to acknowledge that he was crucial for Fairchild Mesa transistor, and his key contribution to all of us was planar process. And on this picture on left side in upper corner, this is actually a copy of this 2N696 world first planar transistor. I can give you some number. This diameter of this collector region is 754 micron. The base diffusion was 10 micron, about 10.4 micron. It's number which I never forgot, because I did a reverse engineering on this transistor, so I know all this number on this part. So Jay Last take the Jean process, and he need to do some modification. That the one of the modification, if you have one transistor in one can, they are isolated, right? The two collectors, they can be on different potential. But that's not the case in integrated circuits. You need to have some isolation. And this was key issue. And this was not solved in Kilby patent. He described, the Kilby patent is describing only one transistor circuits or the flip-flop where transistors are on same potential. And they, I'm considering this like some kind of miracle, because that's really what is this engineering ingenuity and this innovation, what engineer bring to process, that you can, when you see this now on next foil, you can make, you will laugh how naive they were. But if you look back, this was 1959, this was absolutely outstanding work. So what they did, they need to get somehow to separate these two transistor from each other. And they said, well, we will remove completely silicon between them. So if wafer is 80 micron thick, we will etch this and we will completely separate it. But in order to do it, you will have only oxide on the top, which will hold it. Right, so that's, you need some support that the wafer will not fall apart. So they used this black part in middle of picture is bonding wax, and they start with sugar. The sugar has a melting point about 180 degree, and they say, well, after that we can heat this more than 180, sugar will melt, and we can remove the wax. The point was that the sugar destroy oxide. So we know that salt is bad for oxide, but the sugar is not better, all right? But after that, they found something what is still salt in Walgreen, that what is called Apizion wax, and they apply this wax on top side of the wafer, and now they flip a wafer upside down and put this wax on glass plate. Okay, so now they have enough support, because the wafer is sitting upside down on glass plate, and this wax is holding the wafer, it's bonding to a glass. And they can apply mask to backside, But this mask need to be aligned, right? And there where Jay Lars developed this process that he was shining light through the wafer, and they have a special alignment, 3 points, alignment points, and he aligned this mask on the backside of the wafer. And they open a region in oxide, and once they strip resist, they have all wafer was covered with oxide or with wax sitting on this. So they can dip it into solution and they can etch this trench, what you see on this picture on top. So they literally remove a whole thickness of the silicon between two transistors. But now you need to fill it with something. And they used the epoxy. But there was also a major problem, because once the epoxy was drying, it shrink and the wafer cracks. So they need to find a right way, and they found something what is called Sticast, and this was working. And with this, they get the structure like this. So you have a silicon wafer, 80 micron thick, sitting on epoxy, and epoxy is actually creating isolation. So this today you have a STI, or before STI we have a LOCOS, right? So this is what is serve the same purpose like LOCOS or STI. And they start work on it in May 1960. They prepare a concept, and in May 1960 they start run to first batch of samples. And by November they have a yield around 5%, and they have several tens of samples. And this is very unique photographs, which I think it will be first published in my book. It's this, the color picture on left side is photograph of first Fairchild planar integrated circuits. What you see that there is the layout on right side. What is not clear from this schematics is that in this region here, there are two carbon resistors, because this was like RS flip-flop, so you can reset them or set them, and you need two resistors, that they were two carbon resistors which were added after this process was accomplished. So now we have a working integrated circuits with yield about 5%. And now the JLAS group was facing another the problem, what to do with this? Because at that time nobody have idea, nobody want integrated circuits, nobody, you know, people were telling, you have now such big variation between parameters when you have one transistor, so if you put a four transistor into one circuit, it cannot work. And there was basically only skepticism. So in November 1960, Jay Last asked for a meeting, and he wanted to make a decision what will be the future for this project. And this meeting was attended by everybody from top management from Fairchild. Bob Noyce was there, Gordon Moore, all marketing people. And at that time, the Fairchild had in charge of marketing a person was named Tom Bay. And Tom said, you piss off 2 million on this project, nobody asked for it, we should be focused on transistor, and we should never go into this integrated circuits business. And nobody from the people who attend the meeting, not Bob Noyce, not Gordon Moore, said, no, Tom, you are wrong, this is an excellent idea, that's what we need to do. So as many times before in a situation like that, Jay Last resigned from Fairchild. And by January 31st, they separate from Fairchild. And for a while, there was no really interest you know, nobody said, this is really a great idea, this is what will change the civilization and we should benefit from it. What was good is that the Texas Instrument, in the meantime, got a contract for, you know, you need to realize that this was 1960 and we were building missiles for defense. It was the electronics was funded heavily by government and by army. And Texas Instrument was not able to compete with Transistor, but they were doing this publicity campaign that they will have a first molecular computer built. And so the Fairchild have actually no other choice that they need to continue on it. But Jay Last and Jean Hernet separated, but there was guy who remained until his end very bitter and about Gordon Moore and about Fairchild. And this is Lionel Kuttner, who did all this work on these first integrated circuits, and he was never recognized that he was actually crucial. And when Last and Hernet left, he was pushing this project semi-illegally for another year. Okay? And when the Fairchild management saw that there is basically no other solution, that they need to go into it in business, they start to pay a little bit bigger attention to it. And I want to demonstrate what I said with a Fairchild memo, which was issued by Gordon Moore and Victor Greenwich. At that time, they were responsible for R&D, and they were issuing the common monthly report to Robert Noyce. And if you see that this is January 1961, and at that time, the Gordon Moore was still not convinced that integrated circuits is way to go. This is contrary what you can find in literature or in media today, because I can list it. You are 56 names who, or 56 persons who told me that they invented integrated circuits, and some of them are mad of me because I didn't put their name into the book. But I'm absolutely comfortable with claim that first integrated circuits was built by Jay Last Group and was based on excellent idea of planar integrated circuits developed by Jean Hernet. I don't know if you can read this. This is basically chart which summarizes the all what Bob Noyce called bits and pieces come to my mind when I wrote these patterns. This part on the bottom, which is July 30, 1959, that's basically the Noyce patent, which we, which is considered like idea which initiate integrated circuits business. But you see that actually there is many more people who were crucial to this, and there is one group which I didn't mention, that at that time the army was doing very nice work, and they actually developed the resist masking, and they developed aluminum evaporation to do interconnect. And this was the Jay Lathrop and Bob Now. They both joined Fairchild, and actually Bob Noyce visited this army lab, and he was familiar what they are doing, and he was interviewing Jim Null, who was at that time young engineer. He wanted to get a job at Fairchild, and he told him what they are doing. And a few months later, the Bob Noyce used this idea and said, well, that's how we will do this interconnect. But this was in a book, you will find a copy of articles that the Bob Noyce visit this army lab. He was signed on distribution list to receive a copy, and he was also There are also the copy of publication which show that the army did this process 2 years before he applied for this. So we have, or you have tomorrow, important day, and I will try to help you. And I want to just show you what can be done in a reasonable society where you want to make a progress. Okay, this the science today reach a point that no private company can do type of research which can explore the similar things what Bell Labs did, and what ultimately result in transistor and the microelectronics how we see today. Unfortunately, if you look on government funding, you see that not only the number of EE and physicists and chemists is at school is decreasing, but the funding is decreasing. The NSF tried to give us some picture that we are decreasing, but the private business is investing more. And that's one of the very misleading picture, because the private business or the semiconductor manufacturing company are actually investing into real R&D very little. They report it like R&D because this tax code allow that you can use some money for certain work and you can report them like R&D work, but they are basically just designed to prepare something into manufacturing, and very, very seldom they are something what can be called a research. And if we are not able to change this approach, and this government funding will be drying more and more, it will end with only one outcome, which I put there a drawing which is showing what happened with car manufacturing in the United States. In 1900, we had about 400 car manufacturers. Can you imagine that we have in the United States, there was like 400 outlets who built the cars. Right? Now we have 2.5. And if you look on steel industry, if you look on textile industry, if you look on glass industry, if you look on aerospace industry, all follow the same pattern. And we are somehow arrogant and we believe that this cannot happen with microelectronics. You see that in every scientific field, we reach during half century a significant progress. It doesn't matter if you go into chemistry, if you go to medicine or pharmaceutical industry, but all this progress is other science originate in progress in microelectronics. Without the progress in microelectronics, they will be still on level where they were 50 years ago, or with very little progress. This computer, this electronic, the microelectronic progress enable the progress in another science. And that's why this is different than car manufacturing or something else. If we will be not able to keep this in this country, we will not remain a superpower. This is very difficult to explain some people in Washington, and unfortunately this is also very difficult to explain some young people. They told me why I should go to engineering and go every 4 years through this layoff and all this stuff. Well, that's true, but that's when you say this, that's you say in the same token that you are not real engineer. Because if you are a real engineer, you don't work for money. That's engineering, that's the passion. You work because that's this discovery and this realization of what you can do. That's what you need to have in blood. Jean Hernet never made himself rich. The same with Jay Last. But if you ask them if they would change a career, they would tell you no. I was just doing what I enjoy, and I would do it again. And the same is in my case. If I'm young again, I would not do anything else than go to engineering, because I had for more than 40 years I was people say, why you are looking to be at work? Why you go to work at Saturday? Because I relax when I go to work. And that's when you are a real engineer. When you take this, like, you know, you cannot live without it. This will make you a lousy husband, but you will be excellent engineer. Right? So, because you have an important day today, I don't want to keep you busy anymore, but perhaps if you have some question, we can spend 5 minutes and I will try to answer if you have a question. If not, I wish you a good night and hope that I'm convinced that everything will go right in the next 3 days.
Thank you. Thank you for a wonderful talk. If there's a quick question or two, we can take it now. I think Dr. Lojek will be around for the next couple of days also, so I hope you get an opportunity to chat with him. Is there a question or two? Thank you.
Yeah, I'm curious. Did you keep notes all along as you were having a professional career, or did you go back and interview people? How do you have all this documentary evidence?
Well, you know, I am. My father was Jewish, and he never threw anything away. My mother did, and he, you know, when I was a young boy and I walk on street and there was washer, I was taught that I need to pick up the washer and clean it and I can use it. Okay, so, and I developed I'm his son, and I never throw up anything. So I have now one room in basement, and I keep there. It's now about 62 feet of boxes. But I need to tell you that I was very fortunate, because when Bill Shockley died, Amy Shockley gave me some papers which, you know, they are not in Stanford Library, where his material from Shockley Labs is. And I got some paper from Bob Weidler, and I didn't talk about him because he is... I will tell you one story about Bob Weidler. He's also from mixed family. His mother was Czech and his father was German. In my case, it's his opposite. And Bob Weidler was at age 12, he was fixing TV. He was building radio. He joined army, and he wrote a first transistor manual for army. When you read this manual, it has about 42 pages, and I think that's only 42 pages you need to read to understand a bipolar transistor. It's so crisply clear that it's... Now I'm wondering why other books were written after that, because he described it. So I'm one of these person, I said, who is bad husband, but I keep all paperwork and I don't allow my wives that they cannot throw anything away. I keep more. I keep a pieces of wafers. I have a first Texas instrument wafers which Gordon Thiel pull out when he joined a Fairchild. I have a point contact transistor with serial number 6 from Bell Labs. I have this $25,000 transistor book, which Bell Labs was, when you sign a license, you go through a course and you will get this. I keep all this material, and I never actually planned to wrote a book. I have a very big difficulties with language, and I said, no, I cannot do it. But I still occasionally go to my English tutor, and I usually cut something from newspaper and ask her, Caroline, what is this? I don't understand this. And last few years, I was bringing her a couple of times some news clips with President Bush speeches. And he said, look, if you bring me one more clip like this, you cannot come here anymore. This guy is not using a proper English, and I will not deal with this. And you should not speak this language, okay? And so I said, well, maybe I can write a book. If somebody who is really not that... but you need to keep in mind that I'm living in Colorado Springs. So, as you know, the Colorado is Republican's heaven, and it's not, there is not too many people. And I told you about situation in semiconductor industry, and I need to be somehow careful. But that's what brings me to this point that to be engineer, that's not enough. You know, you need to, there are some, when my father told me, you are doing wrong things when you are developing this Nintendo. He was right. I was so excited because the Nintendo was actually where I had the first 0.25 micron E square cell. And it was a big deal for me. But I think that to work for Nintendo is not that bad, but what is bad that when you refuse to use your own brain, when you start to just follow somebody without thinking, and when you know, every time when you listen TV or radio or open newspaper, and if you read it, there is a lot of bullshit. And a lot of people accept it, and they don't think about this, and after that, you know, you have a people and they just repeat it. And I think that that's what is so dangerous, that when people are not reading a book and just following what somebody wants to tell you, that this, I know from my own experience that this is not sustainable. This cannot last. But I am in a situation that I am a naturalized citizen, but I came here and I was, when I came here first day, I said, well, this is my country and I will do everything possible that I will succeed. I never think about that this will be different. I adore America. I was telling, I lost a lot of my friends because I was telling them, look, they have a one-time Republican Democrats, they have a freedom, we need to copy this. And some people told me, well, it's not exactly that. And I was really mad, and I don't understand how they can, after this communist experience, how they can be hesitant and said, well, America is not the best. And when I came here, I realized that America is best. When I was in Palo Alto and when I talked to people who work in Hewlett-Packard, for example, they told me what's going on now in industry will be unimaginable. Or I will tell you another example from my experience. When I came here, I can read English, but I cannot speak almost at all. So I go to library and I found all this book, how to talk to friends and how to talk to your boss and all this. And I bring this book home and I was reading this, and after that I said to my wife, look, we can separate this book into two parts. There is one part of books which was published before 1950, and there is new literature after 1950. This old literature will tell you, if you be honest with a customer, if you do mistake, acknowledge mistake and fix it. The new literature, this business literature, will tell you what tie you should wear, how you find a weak spot and in your opponent. And we change the substance for style, and this is not working. And these people who develop integrated circuits, nobody of them has had a business education or the social science. They were engineers and they learned how to run a business. Today, we have people who run a business and they know nothing about engineering. Okay, and that's why you see this gross mistake that the company acquires somebody. You have now company startups which are scam from the day one. They are just set up to increase the value of stock and sell it and don't produce anything. It's hype. and this cannot work. And if we are not willing to stand up and say this is wrong, or I will be not part of it, this, we have no chance to survive. They always say, well, Americans always find a way. Well, this was true in past, but why this should be that we are only the one who will find a way? Why somebody in Japan or Korea cannot find a way? Right. So I'll drift it a little bit to answer your question. I keep a lot of papers in my basement, and the problem which I have is that I don't know what to do with them. I offer them to Smithsonian, and they are not interested because I said these Shockley papers cannot be separated. And my time is running off, and I need to make a decision what I will do with this material. You know, I have a first non-volatile memory cell because this was my interest from day one. And I have the germanium, which was pulled out during war in my country. What Nazi was using, they called it material X. They didn't acknowledge that this was the germanium. And so I need to find somebody who will be willing to keep this material and this paperwork. If there is no other question, I want to thank you for attention, and I wish you all the best for next 2 days.